Good afternoon, everyone. Nice to see all of you. I learned I had this assignment back on January 31, and I've never had an assignment this close to Passover before, so it was a little intimidating. And so I started early, wanted to do a good job, prepared, got about three quarters of the work all done, was happy with the way things were going, and then Mr. Holliday came up a couple weeks ago, took the subject down to the title. Of course, I wasn't upset. Well, maybe a little bit. But the point of it is we're getting Plan B today. I like to start early on any preparation for any assignment that I have a chance to speak with you because I like to run it first past my fiercest critic, which is my wife. And I have a couple of reasons for that. First one is that she has a keener sense of logic than I do. So if I'm going through with her and she says, I don't think so, and we have a husband and wife debate, and 90% of the time I find I take her suggestion. But I have a secret reason for doing so. You see, if the message doesn't go well, it's really nice to have somebody else to put the blame on. If you wouldn't mind raising your hand today, this will be your first, listen carefully please, or your second, or your third New Testament Passover. Would you please raise your hand so we can see them? Come on up, everybody up. They want to see you. Okay, they're too afraid to put their hands up. Here's another one in the middle with Ron. Okay, thank you very much. If this has been your 10th, if this will be your 10th year or more, would you please raise your hand? 10 or more. Or more. Okay. Keep them up if this will be 20 or more. Keep them all up, 20 or more. How about how it's up if there's 30 or more? Still a lot. How about 40 or more? Do we go 50? Anybody 50 or more? We have a couple 50. Should we try for 55? Okay. All right, thank you. The decades roll by, don't they? A curious thing I found happens during this time of year. We focus in this time of year about things of the crucifixion, about the sacrifice of Christ, and that's as it should be. Now, you would think with a limited number of scriptures, a limited number of topics that we focus on, that you wouldn't learn anything new. Even you've heard it over and over again, right? That's not been my experience. My experience is, maybe every year or every other year at a minimum, I see something from a little different angle. Something new. Or maybe something that prompts a question that I never considered before. And I often find the conversation with my wife on the way home after, for example, tomorrow night, can be a fascinating one because maybe it's because we're focused on the same thing very intensely for about an hour and a half. And we'll both come back and say, did you understand this? And did you see this? I rather enjoy that conversation. Now, the reason I mention is because through the years, I've developed a mental list of what might be called biblical curiosities that spring out of these days. And so I titled the message today very simply, Curiosities That Surround the Crucifixion. Now, before I launch into it, I want to recognize up front that there are always some members who don't exhibit a curiousness. I personally don't understand that. I think they're at risk, if that's how you would categorize yourself, as missing out on a real spiritual treat. One of the wisest men that I've ever known was an elder in the church, and years ago he gave a message that I've never forgotten. He said, if you're going through the Bible and you come across a passage or an idea that doesn't fit with what you understand to be about God, don't jump over that. In fact, he said there ought to be a big neon sign flashing, and the sign should say, dig here, treasure below. Because if something isn't coming clear, he said the Bible is like a jigsaw puzzle. And if you got a piece that doesn't fit, don't get your knife out and whittle on it. Try to make it fit into the jigsaw puzzle. You can do that, but you'd be distorting the picture. Rather, take the piece that doesn't fit and see where it might. And when you find it does fit, oh, well, that changes the picture a little bit. It makes it clearer. It makes it more understandable. Now, I think that that's the way God has put his plan and the message that he has in the book together. It just seems to be the way that it is. Now, I think there's a principle that we can say, that we can find in Paul's writings that capsulizes this idea. We won't turn there, just a simple sentence, but for those who'd like to note it, it's 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 10. It's a very simple phrase. Paul says, "For the Spirit," and he's talking about the Spirit of God, "searches all things, yes, the deep things of God." And I believe that if you have the Holy Spirit actively working in your mind, and you're engrossed with the things in this book, and you're trying to reconcile everything you learned, that what you're going to be doing is following the prompting of the Holy Spirit to grasp the things of God more deeply and more clearly. That just appears to be the way that God has organized things. Now, the first curiosity I'd like to speak about today that surrounds the crucifixion is that of the man Judas Iscariot. You remember Jesus had a meal with his 12 disciples, and during the meal he became troubled. I won't turn there, but it's found in John 13:18. And Jesus said the following, "I do not speak concerning all of you. I know whom I've chosen. But that the scripture may be fulfilled," and then Jesus quotes Psalm 41, "He who eats bread with me has lifted up his heel against me." And of course, he's speaking of the betrayer. We know him as Judas Iscariot. Judas was an essential player in the plan of God. Without Judas, there'd be no betrayal to the authorities. And the scripture of the betrayal had to be fulfilled. But here's the problem. Who chose Judas? In Luke 6's account, we find that Jesus spent all night in prayer before he chose his disciples the next morning. Now, if we ascribe about 12 hours to the night, and there's 12 disciples, that means he spent, on average, 1 hour with each of the disciples praying to the Father, should I choose this one? Should I choose the other one? And that would mean he spent time talking with the Father about who was going to be picked for the job of the betrayer. And Judas was selected. Now, the book of John tells us that Jesus knew from the beginning who it was who was going to betray him. Somebody had to do what Judas did. But I know this. If I knew that the Son on the earth were conversing intently with the Father in heaven about me and said, "I want to pick him for Judas Iscariot," it would scare the living daylights out of me. And it raises a troubling question further. Did Judas have a choice? Or did God fiddle with his mind in such a way that he really didn't have a choice? Was he like a cow going down a narrow fence cow path? Can't turn to the right, can't turn to the left, guy with a cattle prod coming on behind. No choice in the matter. And this is relevant to us because, you see, the Bible shows that Judas did not come to a good end, did he? In fact, Jesus said, "Woe be to that man, for it had been better for him had he never been born." And it makes another important question. If God could fiddle with the mind of Judas, you see, maybe he can fiddle with your mind. And if God has encroached upon Judas's free moral agency, then it raises questions about the character of God. Is he indeed fair? This is one of the curiosities that surrounds the crucifixion. Now, we're given some guidance on men being tempted by the Apostle James. And James, in chapter 1 and verse 13, gives us a principle. James says, God does not tempt any man. I'll read the verse, James 1:13. Let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, catch the next phrase, nor does he himself tempt anyone. And if we take this at face value, we have to conclude that God did not tempt Judas to sin. And then James adds another phrase. He says, but each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Now, if you'll permit me, I'd like to illustrate how I think this worked with Judas. Let's imagine that you have a task. You have to select out of a group of candidates who are otherwise qualified, a new bank president. But you personally know that one of the candidates has a gambling addiction. Think he'd make a good bank president? I had a friend in the church years ago who was a gambler, and he was addicted. His family had raised him to think gambling was perfectly fine. He was broke. All of his friends knew he was addicted to gambling. He was in denial. I love the guy. He was generous, and if it were up to me, I would have little doubt that he'll be in the kingdom of God. His Achilles heel was just different than a lot of other people's Achilles heel. Now, I happened to go visit him one time, and I should explain that he was a manager of apartment buildings. And so when the first of the month rolled by, he would collect the rent checks, but not everybody paid with a check. Some would pay in cash. He'd give them a receipt, keep the cash. And then a few days later, when it came time to turn everything in, he turned in the rent checks along with the cash. Well, I came to visit him right in the place where this had just happened. And he was broke. He was bemoaning the fact. And then he said, I've got $2,000 in my bedroom, but it's rent money. I can't touch that. Now, that told me something about him. At a minimum, he had thought about it. Further than that, he may have been tempted. I am persuaded that if he didn't have the Holy Spirit, a tickle in his mind said, no, it's not yours, he would have been sorely tempted to take the money. Oh, gamble it and then pay the management company back. That's how the justification works. Now, who would you pick for your bank president? Bank president's going to know the security codes. He's going to know the passwords. But you know if he's a gambling addict, sooner or later, the temptation is going to get so great that that hand is going to go in one of the bank's tills. I would imagine that Jesus and the Father agreed to pick a man to fulfill the role of the betrayer who already had a serious character flaw. At least one. You remember the occasion? Chief priests wanted to kill Jesus, but they were afraid to arrest him publicly because they didn't want to riot amongst the crowd who liked him, so they wanted to do it privately. How to do that? Well, they put the word out that anybody who could find where Jesus was and they could go arrest him, there'd be a reward. Guess whose ears that word fell upon? The disciple who had the character flaw. Now, Judas wasn't a bank president, but the New Testament shows that he carried the money bag. And the other disciples knew that he was a thief, they said, because he liked to help himself from the money bag. Now, when Judas chose to go talk with the high priests and negotiate the betrayal of Jesus, do you think the Father or Jesus came down and put the metaphorical gun to his head and frog march him over to find the chief priest to do the bargaining? I don't think so. Matthew 26 and verse 14, we'll pick up the story. Matthew 26 and verse 14. Matthew 26 and beginning in verse 14. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you?" You understand, this is the Middle Eastern bazaar that's going on here. You bargain for what you get. And they counted out to him 30 pieces of silver. Paid in advance, by the way, they were desperate. So from that time, he sought opportunity to betray Jesus. No, the choice was Judas's. Now, surely someone's going to say, wait. Judas was set up. God set him up. How could he be morally culpable? God put him into the tempting situation. Well, I'm afraid if someone makes that argument, they're on shaky ground. First off, I do not believe that Judas became a thief after Jesus chose him as a disciple. That's not the way life works, is it? In fact, if you have any knowledge of criminal jurisprudence, you understand that anybody who's sitting in jail for 30 years as a felon didn't start out that way. They started out as doing petty theft, young teenager, maybe vandalism, got away with it. Maybe got caught for after a while, and then it became a lifestyle. By the time they got to where they committed a felony, they had the long rap sheet. I suspect the reason that Jesus and the Father chose Judas is because he had a long track record of at least being a thief. Second argument is that why Judas can't be excused because of his circumstances is very simple. You and I are placed into a hostile world, aren't we? We have temptations all around us. And we're expected to use our free moral agency to resist the temptation. I don't think that we're ever going to have opportunity to come up to the Father and say, grab him by the lapels and say, "I want a get out of jail free card because you, God, put me in a tempting world." That's not going to work. Now remember, James says that God tempts no man, that every man, when he's tempted, is drawn away by his own lusts and enticed. So I do not believe that Judas can get off by blaming his circumstances. Now we have to be intellectually honest here, because it's true, in the book of John we find something very relevant here. John tells us that the very one who put the idea to betray Jesus into Judas's mind was Satan. Let's just embrace that and get used to that. But there's an antidote by the Apostle James. It's an old Church of God memory verse. It says simply, "Resist the devil and he will flee from you." Judas didn't resist. Judas, once a thought came in his mind, cuddled up to the idea, played with it, and eventually became the owner of it. Now I'm going to try to illustrate what I think is going on with an example on one of my own family's life many years ago. He didn't tell me this until about 20 years after the fact. I have three brothers. One of them, many years ago, became a rock musician, just a local band that would play for people. And on the weekends, he would go over to a friend's house where they would, blast their eardrums out practicing, and they would experiment with drugs. And he said, while I was sitting on the sofa having popped some drugs, the family dog in the place where he was at came over in front of me, sat down on its hind legs, and looked up at me eyeball to eyeball, he said. And the dog said, "If God is so fair, why doesn't he allow us animals into his plan?" And I pushed at my brother a little bit, verbally, and I said, "Now, wait a minute. You were on the drug, right? How do you know that the dog said this to you, that it wasn't just your own mind firing off the buttons?" Now, he got a little agitated at that, and a little testy. And he said with a little bit louder voice, the dog said to me. He was absolutely persuaded. Now, I don't know that Satan was involved. Let's assume for the moment that it was. What did my brother do? He never touched drugs again. He resisted Satan. That's how he did it. Didn't touch the drugs again. So when it comes to Judas, I think we conclude from James clearly that Satan planted the thought, but Judas did not resist the thought. Judas, according to the Apostle James, played with the thought and found it enticing. And if he had stopped there, maybe things would have been okay. But Judas went further. He took action. Judas, you see, made the choice to walk with his feet to find the high priest, the priest to bargain with. Judas used his brain and his mouth to bargain with for the 30 pieces of silver. And then Judas chose to take another action, to begin to actively look for an opportunity to betray Jesus. So we have the thought that came from Satan, but the actions were all Judas's own. He betrayed Judas all by himself. Now, the New Testament speaks 40 times about Judas, all negatively. So I have to conclude that the moral accountability for his actions lay entirely with Judas. Brings up curiosity number two. If God doesn't remove your free moral agency, and he didn't take away Judas's free moral agency, did Jesus have a choice? Specifically, did he have a choice about whether or not to go through with the crucifixion? I used to think for years that he had no real choice. I mean, if you got two scriptures in the Old Testament about Judas and what he was going to do, there are dozens and dozens about Jesus. And it's the focal point of the plan of God. How could he possibly have a choice? Until I heard an elder some years back talk about it. Now, you're already in Matthew, so look down, please, at chapter 26. Chapter 26. The context is in the Garden of Gethsemane. The high priest's servants have come, kind of like a police force. They've got clubs and staves and torches. And Jesus said, up, here they are. Peter gets up, grabs his sword, takes a swing at the servant's head, catches a bit of the ear. Ear falls to the ground. That's context. And then Jesus tells Peter to put away your sword. But the verse I want to focus on is what follows, because Jesus expresses an element of surprise at Peter. Why would he do such a thing? Matthew 26, verse 53. Still talking to Peter. Or do you think that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he will provide me, this is positive, with more than 12 legions of angels? That's between 60 and 70,000 angels. To do what? Well, to deliver him from the chief priests and what was coming. Now, let's read it again. This time I'm going to do it the way the elder did, with the emphasis that he gave. Peter, put away your sword. Or don't you think that I can now pray to my Father, and he will, Peter, provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? All that Jesus had to do, he's telling Peter, was to ask. And he's out of there. Don't you get it, Peter? The alternative is to think that Jesus told Peter a lie. That if Jesus called to the Father would not send him 12 legions of angels. But I believe that Jesus told Peter the absolute truth. That all Jesus had to do to ask, and again that Jesus was surprised that Peter didn't understand this. Now what's the difference, you say? It means that Jesus had a choice. Whether to go through with the crucifixion as planned, or not. Now, I'd like to show you some more evidence for this, like the elder did. Let's rewind the tape and go back 3 hours. We're now in the Garden of Gethsemane. What do we find? Jesus came to the Father and prayed intensely, maybe as any human being ever has. On 3 separate occasions, he asked the same thing every time. He was begging to back out of the crucifixion. Now, Dr. Herman Hay, about 25 years ago, spoke on this topic, and he gave a message about this choice of Jesus. And now, Herman Hay grew up with German immigrant parents. English was his second language, but he spoke English absolutely perfectly. But he retained a Germanic mannerism that was distinct to him. And it was rather authoritative. And so in my mind, I still picture it, and I can still hear it. So forgive me if I do my impersonation of him. Here's what he said. If you think that the Father and the Son have always agreed, you haven't been paying attention. I think he's right. Because at least for 3 hours, right? On Jesus' 33 and a half year experience on the earth, Jesus and the Father did not perfectly agree. Now, he knew, Jesus did, that he should agree. He wanted to agree. But the truth of the matter is that he was not in perfect agreement with his Father. Now, there's more evidence. In Luke's account of this, we find that the disciples noticed something. After the 3rd hour that he had prayed, Luke's account says, an angel came strengthening him. Why? Well, the context shows it's pretty clear. The Father is looking down at his Son, at the focal point of history. And his Son is beginning to go what the English call wobbly. And the implication is that if he had not sent the angel to strengthen him, Jesus was at risk of not choosing to go through with the crucifixion. That means Jesus had a choice. And it has profound implications. Let me illustrate. This is the example that our elder used years ago. He said, you're in World War II. You're in France. Germany has overrun the country, and it's now an occupied country. And you're a member of the French underground. And you've been caught. Now you're in a small room. They got the bright light on you, and 2 Gestapo agents are there. And the first one is beating the living daylights out of you and putting you to torture. And you pass out. And when you come to, he says, I'm going away in 1 hour. When I come back, you're going to get more of the same unless you give us what we want to know. Okay? He leaves the room. Now you've got the other Gestapo agent. He uses, you know, the good cop, bad cop approach. And he says, soft voice, a little kindness. He says, maybe you've seen World War II movies. Maybe he takes a cigarette out of his mouth and gives it to the French underground resistance guy. And he says, look, my friend here is a little over-exuberant in these things. I don't believe in these tactics. I'll tell you what. Here's a sheet of paper and a pen. All we really want is a name. Just give us the name of the person you report to. And do that, and all this stops. You're free to go. You're free to go. We don't care about you. The choice is yours. My friend's going to come back in here after I'm not been successful, and you know what's coming next. Why is this relevant to Jesus? Well, if Jesus had a choice, it means while he's on the cross or the stake, he has to push himself up to grab another breath. You just don't hang there and breathe. You have to push yourself up on the spikes and pull yourself up on the nails to get a breath. So the 1st hour goes by. Okay, he hasn't slept for 24 hours. He's been beaten with 49 stripes. He's been beaten by others with rods. Nothing to drink. I said, no sleep for 20, for you know, a whole night's sleep is gone. Do you think he might start to get weary in the mind and in the body? You ever been super, super fatigued where you just can't go on? What's relevant is that the words and part of his mind may well be that of what he told Peter. All I have to do is ask, and my Father will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels, and I'm out of here. But he didn't choose that. He pushed himself up again. And he made the choice to do it again. And again, why? I don't think it was for his sake. It was for your sake and my sake and for the sake of the Father's plan in bringing many children unto glory. Curiosity number three. Please turn to Matthew 27. That's another page ahead. This context is about a trial of Jesus in front of Pilate. Matthew 27. We'll pick it up in verse 15. Now you've got the chief priests arrayed in all their regalia. You've got Jesus standing before him tied and bloodied. You've got the mob or the crowd that's being worked up, crowding into whatever courtroom setting that there was. Matthew 27, verse 15. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to releasing the multitude one prisoner whom they wished. And at that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release to you? Barabbas or Jesus, who was called Christ?" For he knew that they had handed him over because of envy. Verse 19. While he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, "Have nothing to do with that," note the words, "just man. For I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him." I want you to picture this. Let's change the setting a little. Put it in a modern American courtroom. You got a federal judge. He's sitting there stone sober. Got his black robes on. Maybe you've got a notorious case. You've got a camera in the courtroom reeling. The judge is aware of all of this. The bailiff comes up, hands the judge a note. It's from his wife. Judge stops the trial, reads the note. His wife says, "Have nothing to do with him. He's an innocent man. I've had terrible nightmares over this. I want you to let him go." Why did she have a dream? Why did she tell her husband? Why did the gospel writer think it was so significant that he included it in the narrative? Verse 20. But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "What then shall I do with Jesus who is called Christ?" They all said, "Let him be crucified." Then the governor said, "Why? What evil has he done? Show me the evidence." But they cried out all the more, saying, "Let him be crucified." When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising. You know, they're about, it's feast time, about 1 million people maybe in Jerusalem. The last thing a Roman governor wants is a riot on his hands. Now he's got to answer back to Rome. He took water, washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of this just person." The same words that his wife had written to him. "You see to it." And all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." And again, I have to ask, why is this account in the Bible? Obviously, Matthew felt it was important or he wouldn't have included it in the narrative. Now, the Apostle John tells us that Jesus came unto his own and his own received him not. And there's no clear example of this in the passage that we've just gone through. But I believe there's something else involved here. Let me try to illustrate it with a story. It's a true story. About 20 years ago in the Church of God, there was a man who fancied himself important. He took a following away from the Church of God after him, and he took a title from the book of Malachi. He said that he was the Elijah which was to come. And apparently that didn't suffice. He was later on took the title of apostle. That wasn't enough because years later he took the title of being one of the last two witnesses that's spoken of in the book of Revelation. And then he knew who the other one was. A couple months later, he designated his wife as being the other of the last two witnesses. Now, I think any objective person who thinks about this would not be wrong for them to think the person was a nutcase. But we're not done. Because he eventually got in trouble with all the money that people were sending him with the IRS. The IRS took him in front of a judge, and he was found guilty of income tax evasion. He's now sitting in a federal penitentiary. What do outsiders think if they were to hear and find out of the background of this man? Would they think, well, this is God's man, it's obvious? I don't think so. Well, what's irrelevant to Jesus and the trial that Pilate had? Well, I believe that Matthew's account is important, including Pilate's wife's dream, because of all the future people that God had yet to call. See, up until that time, God had only dealt with the seed of Abraham, and they were concentrated in a little tiny country about the size of New Jersey called Israel. But God had in mind all the Gentiles, something that had never percolated into the minds of the early church. And the gospel had to go to the civilized world, at least, and that was the Roman world. And God had in mind people like Saul of Tarsus, people like the Gentile Luke, Apollos, Timothy, Titus. They're all going to have to be in the front line, and they're going to have to answer some questions about this Messiah. He was killed how? In a Roman crucifixion? That's how he died? And you want us to believe that he's God's good guy? Paul, in answering these charges, could say, in effect, all you got to do is check the court transcript. Pilate called him just and innocent and did what? Washed his hands publicly. No, you could represent the Messiah as never having been an insurrectionist against the Roman Empire, which would have discredited him in large parts of the Roman Empire. Nor was he a common criminal that sat in a jail. I believe God took, as metaphorically, his little finger, flipped the domino by putting a dream in Pilate's wife so that it would influence her husband at a critical moment. God's done this before. You've seen it with Pharaoh back in Egypt. You've seen it with Nebuchadnezzar at the time of Daniel. The dream came to Pilate. Pilate used the language he did, and he washed his hands in public, a phrase that is still used in the English language to this day. Curiosity number 4. We'll look a little further in Matthew 27. Drop down to verse 50. The context is that Jesus is being crucified, and it's coming near the end. Verse 50. And Jesus cried out again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. Then behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked, and the rocks split. And the graves were opened. I'm going to stop here. The graves were opened. I lived in Southern California over 30 years. And if you go to the Mount of Olives today, you're going to see thousands of graves lining that. And sometimes they're 2 and 3 deep. And the ones you see are above ground. They look like a limestone bathtub with a lid on top. And all the earth has to do is shake a little bit. You're going to have a lid slide off. So verse 52, and the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints who had fallen asleep were raised. And coming out of their graves after his resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared unto many. Now, I'm sorry. From when I was a youth on, I thought this was plain weird. Were they zombies, you know, coming into the city? What's going on? Well, I want you to imagine you're sitting at your home in Jerusalem. Get a knock at the door. It's your grandmother. She's been dead 15 years. She's all rotted. You think you've seen a ghost. I don't know how you'd recover talking with her, but you wouldn't be sure of your own sanity, would you? You'd go take it to the neighbor. And they would talk. Do you think the neighbor is going to keep quiet about such a thing? They were all at her funeral, a couple hundred. Now it's going to spread all over the place. They didn't have the internet, but something like this going. Many came out of the graves and appeared unto many. Why? Why is this in here? Why would God do such a thing? Well, the order was a little bit significant. You had an earthquake when Jesus died. Lid slid off a little bit. Didn't come up yet. Jesus had to come up first. When he came up first, then the bodies came into town. Now, they had to die twice, I suppose. There are 2 billion Christians in the world today. And most of them have an Easter tradition where they believe that Jesus rose bodily from the grave. And you don't have to be a Christian in the world today to be aware of that Christian belief that Jesus was resurrected. But you see, there was no such culture like that in 30 AD, that a man could easily come back from the grave. That's laughable. And if humans were dismissive of the otherwise crazy notion that a man could come back to dead, then no one was likely to believe that Jesus had come back from the dead. If no one believed that Jesus had been risen from the dead, the entire plan of God comes to a halt. And the crucifixion and the suffering of Jesus would have been all in vain. So what did God do? Well, we started with Lazarus, not that long before Jesus was crucified. You remember the story? Lazarus was dead 3 days, that's the legal term, plus one more day, making it four. Nobody could gainsay it. Jesus called him up and said, "Lazarus, come forth." The people who were around and witnessed the whole thing, the funeral parley, went back into Jerusalem and told everybody. Well, told a lot of people. They came streaming out because they wanted to see Jesus who could raise the dead. They also wanted to see Lazarus, the man who was raised. This event became the trigger point for when the chief priest said, "This guy's got to go." And they decided at that time to kill him. But interestingly, not only did they decide to kill him, they had to kill Lazarus also, because you can't have the incontrovertible evidence of this man walking around alive. So the crucifixion happened. The earthquake happened. The lid slid off. They came into the city and appeared unto many. Can you see in an environment like that, the idea that Jesus of Nazareth could also be raised from the dead? Doesn't seem like such a far-fetched idea then, does it? Now, is there a common denominator through these curiosities that are spoken about today? I believe there is. I believe that there is a highly intelligent creator who thinks way ahead. I have a book at home, and in it, it talks about 28 prophecies that were all fulfilled just in the day that Jesus was crucified. You know, there's a lot of moving parts here. There's a lot of moving parts because humans have free moral agency. You're not sure what they're going to choose. Now, in this choice, what we've seen today is that Judas had a choice. God didn't take away the freedom to choose of Jesus. Pilate's wife had a dream, and the saints came back from the graves and appeared unto many. I think what we see here is God as a conductor of a grand symphony, maybe the greatest since creation itself. And it all had to come off without a hitch. Last year at this time, I was reading an article by a Jewish man, and he was rehearsing about the Passover of Moses back in Egypt and the days of unleavened bread. And he used a phrase that caught my ear. He said, "When I do these days, I feel like I'm in harmony with the universe." I like that phrase, because I felt a little bit from time to time these days in harmony with the universe. But I think you'll agree that we're more privileged than that. Tomorrow night, when we partake of the symbols of the death of Christ, something our Jewish friend doesn't yet understand, we will not be just in harmony with the universe. We will be in touch with the very heartbeat of the Creator, who planned it all out, and despite human free moral agency, made it all happen.